the RNC ever make it to town? City officials say they can't support it now without more answers. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a conversation with City Council President Tommy Hazzouri, who now says he cannot support the Republican National Convention in Jacksonville. Get on the line. It's 549-2937. Then later, why we now live in two political nations. A conversation about our warring tribes with author Spencer Critchley. But first this hour, the latest on the pandemic crisis by the numbers. Statewide, we're at nearly 380,000 cases and 5,345 deaths. In our area, the death toll is at 190. Overnight, a 9-year-old girl in Putnam County died from coronavirus. Now, amidst these numbers, city officials are meeting this Friday to try to get some answers about how the Republican National Convention will be handled next month here in downtown Jacksonville. At the same time, a lawsuit asking a judge to force the RNC host committee to put together a more detailed plan for health and safety will be heard in court next week. The big news this morning, the president of the Jacksonville City Council has thrown a monkey wrench into all this planning. He says he just can't support the event. Right now, we welcome City Council President and former Mayor Tommy Hazzouri. He's on the line. President Hazzouri, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for inviting me.
Good to have you on the show. Also with us, W.C. Gentry. He and several other prominent local attorneys have filed the RNC lawsuit in district court. W.C., good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. Here's our question to callers. Where do you stand on RNC plans? What are your questions about the latest on the troubles plaguing convention planning for Jacksonville in August? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. All right, Council President Hazzouri, we are a month out from this event. And yesterday you threw a big wrench into the planning. You say you're opposed. Unless you can get some better answers from the city for health and safety planning, you oppose a bill filed by the mayor Wednesday that lays out more of the planning and logistics around the RNC. What is driving your opposition?
Well, it's obvious that the health, safety, and welfare comes first for us, for any president, for any governor, for any mayor of any city. That is our first responsibility. This bill does not do that as it stands. We've got a 37-page bill plus another 40 pages of exhibits, contracts that we're trying to digest. It, what the sheriff said the other day, not having the resources, that's not just a no-brainer, that's a stopgap as far as I'm concerned for, and I'm sure that other council members, while I can't speak for them, is the same for them unless the sheriff feels comfortable and he's going to be coming to us on Friday to give us any kind of an update. The other side is, and it's just as big a piece, is the pandemic. It's not addressed. You know, EMTs, sort of like a football game, and they still think it's like a football game coming here, and it's definitely not. This is 10 times bigger. They've doubled down with this convention, and nobody addresses what happens to all the people who come on airplanes, who visitors, delegates, come on airplanes, drive here, trains, cars, whatever. And what are you going to do? Give them a temperature check and ask them if you cough like you normally do at a doctor's office or at a hospital? Where are we going to put these people? Because we can almost count on a number of them being a percentage being done by having an infection. And where are we going to put them? Hospitals? What housing are we going to put them in? Are we quarantining them? These kinds of questions aren't spoken to in this bill. And this bill is not a policy bill. It's what the general counsel has drafted with the RNC general counsel for the convention. Joy Lee is her name.
Doesn't it primarily deal with how the mayor can spend about $33 million in federal security funds?
Absolutely.
Okay. Let me just bring attorney W.C. Gentry into the conversation, because you have filed a lawsuit that will be heard next Tuesday
before
in district court about, yeah, go ahead.
Before you do it, let me just qualify, and W.C., you can address this. I don't want to have to speak to that because it is a lawsuit against the city, I suppose. I don't know. And I don't want to get caught
up. That's fine. Yeah, sure. No problem. I'll keep you in your bucket and Mr. Gentry in his. WC, what is the new motion that you filed to your lawsuit asked Judge Katie Deering to do? What specifically are you demanding of the plaintiffs, the defendants in your lawsuit?
Well, in the lawsuit we filed under the 1917 statute that allows a citizen to bring a claim to enjoin a nuisance, which is anything that adversely impacts the health and welfare of the community, we're seeking the court to enter orders requiring the Trump campaign and RNC to do everything reasonably appropriate to assure the safety and welfare of our community and to minimize the risk. We know the CDC has published that the greatest risk of spread of COVID-19 is when people come from out of town and gather together in groups. And that's exactly, of course, what we have. And it's the greatest risk. And we know it's going to be a terrible problem for our community. So we filed supplemental information with the court on a Monday regarding events that have transpired since, and ask the court to, more specifically, to require them to establish a comprehensive plan, such as the CDC has already outlined in a multi-page document, basically saying you shouldn't have events, you shouldn't have gatherings, but if you do, and it contemplates much smaller events than these are the sort of things you have to do, and it's a very comprehensive plan to try to quickly determine if anyone has an infection. Ways, there has to be, like President Missouri said, there has to be ways to deal with that, to hospitalize these people, to quarantine these people, and then at every step of the way, there has to be monitoring and management to assure that people are wearing masks and maintaining space to minimize the spread of the disease, because we're going to have thousands of people coming here, congregating together, and then moving throughout our community and infecting hundreds, if not thousands, of people in our community. It is a tremendous risk, and it can at least be minimized if they do that. And from everything we've been able to determine, they don't have any plan other than to take temperatures and to offer people masks. That's the only thing
okay.
they've indicated they thought of.
Yeah, and as you asked the judge to mandate more specific planning, Council President Hazuri, the TU today reports that Brian Hughes, the city's chief administrative officer, has said in emails to you that they don't need, essentially saying they don't need city council approval to go ahead with the convention, even if a majority of city council members vote against this bill that lays out the mechanisms for funding and security. So what's your response to that?
And it's not a majority, it's two-thirds. I think it needs to be made clearer that it takes two-thirds. Being introduced as an emergency in and out, which means we have to vote by two-thirds of the 19-member council to take it up as an emergency, and then vote the bill either up or down with another two-thirds. So that's not a majority. That's two-thirds of our council. But let me speak to this. You know, we have two contracts in this exhibit, as well as the parade route and a number of other things. But we knew from the beginning, this agreement, in my judgment, is a contract, but Carla Miller, our ethics person and overseer for contracts and agreements, has been reviewing this. I talked to her again today. I want to hear her opinion on what our commitment is, because it goes into effect in around 20 days. Well, time isn't on anybody's side on this, and I disagree with them. I've heard that from the beginning.
So let me just ask you then, if it comes to a standoff between you, the president of the Jacksonville City Council, and the people who vote with you on the council, and Mayor Lenny Curry and the RNC host committee, who wins this Mexican standoff? Because they're saying that they don't need, under the law, they don't need your approval to do this event, which has become hugely controversial and which a majority of residents clearly don't want here in town. So who? What's your strategy to win that standoff?
Let me just read a one-liner at the end of the agreement or the bill that says, requesting emergency passage upon introduction, At the end of that, it says, and the city needs the approval of this legislation in order to adequately prepare for the event. They won't get the pass-through money, the $33 million. They won't get the support of the city council. They certainly won't be able to provide for the health, safety, and welfare of the community. To me, it's a dead issue if the council voted it down. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, Melissa. We want to ask the hard questions on Friday in between. The council members now have that bill. They can start thinking about their questions. I don't want a big overall debate Tuesday night. I want to get most of these questions answered. And if they can't answer them, you know, the risk are the people. The risk is the people. You know, that, and I think the sheriff indicated that he puts public safety ahead of politics. And I think that's what our council has to do. It's our fiduciary responsibility. It's being prudent, and it's being honest. It's my hope that maybe they won't continue with this and say, it's no Mexican standoff. We think that it's too great a risk. Let's go to virtual or do whatever they want to. But, you know, we expect the big day to be Thursday, Axe Handle Saturday, an event to take place. And also with the president here, you know, he's a lightning rod. So people, if we want to say it's going to be a peaceful protest, maybe for our local people, but for those who come from out of town and maybe out of the country, I want to throw caution to the wind on this thing. I think that we have to expect the worst and hope for the best.
All right, let's go to some calls now for Jacksonville City Council President Tommy Hazzouri. Also with us, Attorney W.C. Gentry. And what we just heard the council president say is that if the majority of the council, or two-thirds, he said, votes his way, the council will use the power of the purse to essentially withhold funding for the Republican National Convention. I'm paraphrasing his comments. The mayor's chief administrative officer is quoted as saying they believe the convention could continue without council approving funding. That said, let's go to some of your calls. 549-2937, Landon in Murray Hill. Landon, good morning. Go ahead.
Morning. First of all, I just want to say thank you very much to the city council president. You are making a whole lot of sense with what you're saying, and I appreciate your use of common sense and your approach to putting public safety ahead of politics. That takes a lot of bravery, and I respect you very much for doing so. I totally agree with what he's saying, and as a citizen of the community, it does feel like certain people in power with a particular political leaning are putting politics above my safety. Even the fact that they would be willing to take the risk under the current conditions that Florida is experiencing, literally experiencing the peak of our place in the pandemic, to even consider things like this and reopening schools just seems like the risk in my human life is very much not as valued as just getting back to business, and I'm sure a lot of other people feel the same way. So I just think there needs to be some sort of addressing of the ambiguity and the subjectivity of, hey, we can and can't do this, and where does the value of human life come into play, and where do you actually put that marker in place to make this such a less subjective thing for people, because it makes so much common sense to some of us out here.
All right,
and
Landon.
To others, they just seem to be playing politics.
Thank you for that, Landon. You know, W.C. Gentry, a listener sent me a piece from today's New York Times looking at where the coronavirus is sending people to hospitals. Jacksonville has the second highest percentage of cities in Florida where COVID is sending affected patients to hospitals, and we are currently in the top 20 for all cities in America. We're in the top 20 metro regions with the most severe hospitalization rates. This is at the heart of your lawsuit, this concern.
Yes, it is. And, of course, no one's even talked about what happens if we have 10,000 people coming from out of state, which there'll be at least that many. There are going to be hundreds of them that will come here already infected and will start getting sick when they get here. And no one's even addressing what the RNC will do to identify them and help them. Are they just going to dump them on the front steps of our hospitals? How will our hospitals handle that? That is a major issue that must be addressed and planned for if they're going to go forward with this.
549-2937. Jay is in Mandarin. Good morning, Jay. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, I wanted to also thank Tommy Azuri, and I want to thank you too, Melissa Ross, for doing the show that you do every morning.
Thank you. Thanks for listening.
I've called here a couple of times, and I've asked, obviously, the same question. I don't understand why this is always a question asked, but the common sense should come into play that you yourself said this morning a 9-year-old died in Putnam County, but our own governor is claiming that children aren't going to be really at risk at all. Now we have an RNC coming in August, knowing that there is no plan. The hospital beds and ICUs are getting filled up, and we know all these things are happening. Why is it that a political agenda for anyone, a mayor, a governor, anybody, is taking precedent over our lives? Because literally, it doesn't matter if you live in Mandarin where I live, or if you live on the north side, or you live on the east side, or the west side. It doesn't matter where you live, what color you are, how much money you make. This is a virus. Death is death. And this is not a joke, and it's happening everywhere. And now it's becoming a political agenda versus just common sense and humanity.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you. Didn't mean to cut you off there, Jay. Let me direct that to the council president. President Hazuri, you say you are hoping to get bipartisan support on the council to essentially kill this bill unless your questions are better answered. This is seen as a partisan thing. The polling on this is certainly partisan. A majority of Jacksonville residents oppose the RNC coming to town, but more Democrats and independents oppose it than Republicans. The mayor has said that this is a big economic driver for the city and not a partisan move. So what's your response to these callers who feel that the leadership that's working to bring this in are putting politics over public health?
I'd like to think the mayor has done a good job and the governor up to a point of making sure that before we phase in, that go into phase two, that mandated masks here in the city, social distancing, but notwithstanding that, they're moving like Ralph Nader said with the Corvair. They're going. It's unsafe at any speed, in my judgment. And right now, I think we have a majority, obviously, on the council who are Republican. I can't speak for them, but I know that they are carefully looking at what's happening. The sheriff kind of hit it right on the head. And you could hear the rumblings among the council members. You can't talk to them about their vote. And I'm not here to just say, tout, let's stop it. But I guarantee you that the questions that we're going to be asking, all 19 of us, in addition to what we've already asked, if they don't get answered, there's no rhyme or reason why we should support this legislation. And the two biggest pieces, obviously, financial and the pandemic. And, when we talk about financial, we don't know where that money's going. The sheriff doesn't get his money, and he certainly can't protect the fight homicides and robberies and others and be downtown at the same time with a limited number of police officers, men and women in blue. And they're going to be in neighborhoods. The parade will be in neighborhoods on the east side, downtown, La Villa. So I think our council will be very honest and very prudent in their thinking, and I'm not going to try to convince them to go the way I feel. I would think that some of them feel the same way, both Republicans and Democrats, and that, in fact, when it comes down to it, say enough is enough.
Mm. Well, we're getting so much feedback about this. Dr. Nancy Statz, part of a group called Doctors Fighting COVID, has sent an email blast that included media. She writes, City Council is voting Friday on the RNC. It is not safe, according to health experts and our own Sheriff Mike Williams. Please contact your city council member ASAP and encourage them to stop the convention. So obviously, council members getting lobbied on this. Jason tweets the show 5 weeks out from the 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday, and not one significant proposal towards police reform in Jacksonville as the convention comes to town. And that, of course, brings up the other big controversy around this event. In addition to the public health concerns, it is seen as rubbing salt in the wound to those calling for a fresh look at institutional racism in this community and observances of the 60th anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday, which was a large civil rights demonstration in August of 1960 in this community. On Facebook, lots of comments, and they are falling into those two buckets, concerns about public health and protests. Hope writes, it would be a powerful message if city council stood up and stopped the RNC. To have this convening on a sacred day in our history and during a surging pandemic is offensive and dangerous, she writes. Let's go to a few more callers. Matthew is downtown. Hi, Matthew. Good morning.
Good morning. I just have a quick question for Mr. Hazuri. I mean, given the president's habit of not paying security costs for his rallies and campaign events, a la El Paso and others, what assurances, if any, do we have from the RNC / the campaign that they will actually pay the security costs, which I'm sure y'all are aware will be significant? And that's my question.
Sure. Thanks for that. You know, Tommy Hazuri, the head of the RNC host committee, told the Southside Businessmen's Club this week at a luncheon, and this was reported on, that it's full steam ahead, that they will figure out the funding and not to worry. So what about all this?
You know what? That's the most unbelievable statement from anyone. I heard the Republican National Convention chairperson argue with the moderator the other day on CNN. How, you know, this isn't 2 years down the road. It's less than 40 days away. All of a sudden, they've never come up with answers. They say we're going to take care of it. Well, you know, that's a cop-out and a half. Let me mention something, and in all due respect to what they said about the convention coming here, that it's going to generate $100 million. I think the mayor's already alluded that they don't think they could come close to that, or at least not get that, and they won't. But you know, and I get it that our retailers, our hotelers, it's an economic boon for however long they're here, but not at the price that we have to pay for police protection, for the pandemic. And again, I think that they're heading in the wrong direction. For the doctor who said, we're not voting, I want to make that clear, we're voting on Tuesday evening at our council meeting. We're not voting, if we vote at all, we're not voting Friday. It's a workshop. And we've asked a number of participants from the Republican Party, from the mayor's office, from our own council auditor's office, and others to answer the questions that the council members will be asking. So it's not a vote on Friday. It's a workshop. But and everybody's entitled.
Thanks for that, Claire. Thank you for that clarification. Yeah. Here's a tweet from a listener. For local business owners, a few days of RNC sales are not worth the devastation that will be left after the last piece of confetti falls. Jacks will be shut down again. The virus will run rampant. Schools, if they're even open, will close again, etc. WC Gentry, you know, we are looking at parameters for a convention that are basically what President Trump would have enjoyed if he had just stayed in Charlotte, North Carolina, which was the original host city. They pulled out of Charlotte and came here to Jacksonville because that state would not allow him a fully packed convention hall with no masks, no social distancing, which is what he wanted. Now, though, as he comes to Jacksonville, he will essentially be looking at a smaller group of people attending, and the city is under a mask order. We are hearing, as Council President Hazuri said, that there will be a parade route along with a First Amendment or free speech zone. And so as you factor in all this new information into your lawsuit, what are your concerns about how all of these logistics will be addressed?
Well, that is a major concern, is how things will be implemented. We know they are here because the mayor and the governor solicited them to come here after they said they did not want to be in Charlotte because Charlotte was going to make them follow the rules. So they came here so they wouldn't be subject to those rules. We know from the experience with Vice President Pence when the RNC host committee met out at Epping just a week ago that they didn't wear masks and they violated the mask order. And then the city concluded that they didn't violate the mask order because there was actually room in the area for them to socially distance. And so they didn't have to wear a mask, even though they glommed together in little groups and were in close proximity and potentially infecting one another. So without management and monitoring of this convention, along with everything else, we know that probably what happens is there's a room that's set aside with lots of room to socially distance. They don't wear masks, and then they're right back together like they did in Tulsa. We know what happened in Tulsa when they removed the stickers from the seats and refused to socially distance and didn't wear masks, and then all congregated together in front of the president. So there's a history here that's very clear that once they get to where they're going, they're not going to follow the rules. So we're going to have to monitor and manage the attendees, and that's got to be the responsibility of the RNC and of the Trump campaign. But having the rules doesn't mean they're going to be followed.
Lots of emails. Judy in Atlantic Beach writes, I applaud both the citizen lawsuit against the RNC meeting here and Council President Hazzouri for his leadership. She goes on to say, the fearful presence of militia-like figures in Portland, Oregon is a realistic possibility on the Jacksonville scene as protesters will make their voices heard. Tommy Hazzouri, we've heard a lot about that in recent days. Worries that on the heels of Jacksonville Sheriff Mike Williams saying he can't secure this event, that could potentially give the green light for more federal forces to come into this community. And certainly, let's be clear, they would be here anyway for a national political convention. So we don't want to overstate, the facts on the ground. That's something we would see anyway. But what's your response to those who are worried about the presence of more federal troops coming into Jacksonville to quell potential protests?
Well, I haven't heard, Melissa. I haven't heard about federal troops. I know federal law enforcement will be here. I haven't heard the term troops like they're talking about in Portland. You know, people say, well, we're not going to experience what Portland does. We don't know what we're experiencing. What WC said about Tulsa is a good example. I mean, I don't want a Tulsa here. I daggum sure don't want a Portland, Oregon occurring here. And I think that's one of the things that the sheriff is concerned about, that he can't give us enough protection. And the image and the optics of federal troops here for something that shouldn't be here in the first place, or an issue or an event that shouldn't be here in the first place. You know, let's go back to Carolina. I think there's money that's still in some of these, some of the conventions have been held that are still owed. That's the other part of the money issue, that are still owed to their cities that they haven't been reimbursed on. And then on top of that, Governor Cooper was absolutely right. He didn't say anything or do anything that we're not doing right now here in Jacksonville. His concerns were the same concerns that we have here today. And, you know, the president of the United States ought to take a lead on this and say, we're going virtual. We're not going to do it. We're making a mistake. He knows how to do it. Texas two-step on a lot of issues. He says he's wearing masks now and on. I don't want to put him on a spot of criticize him. He gets enough as it is. But the important thing is he can say, as the head of the party, the titular head of the party, that the time has come to fold it and turn out the lights and go home.
Jack tweets the show, since Mayor Curry has treated the public with contempt for the past several years, why should the council even give him an inch of what he wants? Plus, why should we limit protesters to a small penned-in area when we're told to socially distance? Why not let them go into the city? Jack, thanks for your feedback. You know, these free speech zones have been a hallmark of conventions, though, for at least the last 15 years. So it's not I do want to make sure people understand it's not a new thing to cordon off protesters. WC Gentry, you are going before a judge in district court next Tuesday. Can you quickly set the stage for us as how your case will progress?
Well, we have a hearing in circuit court.
Circuit court. Thanks for the correction.
Circuit court. That's okay. State circuit court. We have a hearing Tuesday, and it's a case management hearing, and the judge there will decide how she wants to proceed going forward. We may have some matters heard at that time. It's somewhat unclear. We're still waiting to see the motions that the four defendants will be filing. And as soon as I see those, then I'll have a better idea, you know, what may happen. But I hope that I think the hearing on Tuesday, and the judge has set out an order and she specifies what will occur. And it does indicate we'll take up pending motions,
all
but
right.
Also do do planning.
All right. And quickly, Council President Hazzouri, the workshop is on Zoom. Is that right? Friday, as you take up these issues?
There's no public participation, but it is on Zoom. There will be public participation on Tuesday evening. But this one is for a Q&A by the council.
And we're out of time, and I want to thank you both so much, City Council President Tommy Hazzouri, Attorney W.C. Gentry. Thank you both, gentlemen.
Thank you, audience. Thank you, Melissa, W.C. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Still ahead, how sharing your mic on social media can amplify voices that need to be heard, but up next.
The masks have become, you know, not a health measure so much as a tribal signifier for a lot of people.
Author Spencer Critchley on our tribal political divide in a moment.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Welcome back. Well, whether it's wearing or not wearing a mask, your position on abortion, police reform, school funding, you name it. Any hot button topic right now has been magnified in its divisiveness by both the Trump presidency, but even the pandemic we're living through. Is it possible to even bridge these divides? And how do we gain a better understanding of the roots of the two different nations we live in? I spoke about it with author Spencer Critchley. His book is Patriots of Two Nations. Take a listen. Spencer, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
You know, anyone who's watching what's happening in America right now, I think, has observed that we are two nations, two different tribes of people occupying the same land, which is the theme you get into in your book. And nowhere are we seeing the culture war exhibited more obviously than with this acrimony over wearing face masks. Why do you think the cultural and political divide is showing itself right now over masks?
Well, I think you're right. The masks have become, not a health measure so much as a tribal signifier for a lot of people. And as I argue in the book, I think that the culture war is part of this, but it's not the whole story, and it's even bigger than that, which is why it's so hard for people who oppose Trump and who would wear face masks have such a hard time understanding people who are refusing to wear a mask and who support Trump despite all of the reasons that you might offer for them to oppose Trump. And it's really beyond culture, and it gets to worldview. And as I describe in the book, it dates back to the founding of the country in the principles of the Enlightenment. We all assume that reason triumphed in the Enlightenment. It's been basically progress ever since. But what we missed is that there was a counter-Enlightenment, which consisted of a lot of people who rejected this idea that reason should be the ultimate arbiter of truth and authority and wanted to stay with a pre-Enlightenment world in which faith and tradition and ethnic identity and loyalty and ties to the land were more powerful than reason. And so we look today, you know, if we're people of the Enlightenment, as I consider myself, and we look at people who refuse to wear a face mask, which seems crazy from the Enlightenment worldview. If you look at it from the counter-Enlightenment worldview, in that worldview, trust in the leader may very well outweigh science. And in fact, they often feel hostile to science because they feel it reduces the world to a world of mechanism and soullessness, and they prefer a world of faith and tradition and culture and all of those things.
That's a good way of helping people understand the origins of this. And in your book, you talk about this. There are a lot of other examples you could point to. This idea that we are living in alternate realities in this country, that people literally aren't seeing and experiencing the same reality. I think that's pretty worrisome. Do you think it is?
Yes, it is. And you know, I really don't believe the country has ever actually been united. It's, you know, in some ways it's been the divided states of America since the beginning. The founders were men of the Enlightenment and believed they had created the world's first civic nation, meaning a nation based on the social contract, which is basically a rational agreement that we will live together on, under the Constitution and the laws. And I think they really failed to understand how powerful a resistance to that idea would be, and failed to understand that words mean different things within these two worldviews, what I call the Enlightenment worldview and the counter-Enlightenment worldview, so that even truth itself is defined differently. And you see this in arguments throughout the history of the country, most violently in the Civil War, which first of all was fought, of course, over slavery. But it was also a revolt of the counter-Enlightenment worldview against the Enlightenment worldview, the world of tradition, agriculture, ties to the land, ethnic identity in the South versus modernity and science and industrialization in the North. And we're seeing an upwelling of that under Trump. And when you look at the arguments that go on between, say, Trump supporters and Trump opponents in the present day, the reason those arguments are often not only a waste of time, but actually can make things worse, is that if you consider a divisive issue, for example, like abortion, they're talking about two different subjects, and you're using words to refer to two different truths. So somebody who opposes abortion rights is likely to believe that an abortion kills a child, and that's the way they're looking at it. And they may also believe it destroys a soul. And somebody who favors abortion rights will be arguing for the equality of women within an Enlightenment framework. Well, they're literally arguing about two different realities there.
Right. And there are so many other examples, guns, how we apportion our tax dollars, especially when it comes to schools, but so many other areas of division. And so all of this is really getting heated as we get into the 4 months leading up to Election Day. What are you anticipating?
Well, I think that actually, you know, all the signs point towards Joe Biden winning and Trump rapidly losing support. Now, I always want to caution people, you should never use today's polls to predict the results of an election weeks or months down the road, because reality is emerging. It's an emergent phenomenon, and we literally cannot predict the future. We, by definition, cannot predict the future, as much as we might want to. But I think actually what's happening to Trump's support right now also fits in with this Enlightenment versus counter-Enlightenment framework, because within the counter-Enlightenment worldview, loyalty is and faith are, as I've been saying, you know, they can trump almost anything else, if you'll forgive the pun. And once someone has pledged their loyalty to the leader, it's kind of like a medieval knight pledging loyalty to the king. Nothing will shake that loyalty except a demonstration that the leader is not worthy of that loyalty. So if you imagine you're on a battlefield and you witness the king running around in circles, obviously having no idea what he's doing and running away from danger, that's what will shake the loyalty. And I think we've seen through Trump's mishandling of the coronavirus pandemic and the literal, you know, loss of life that's resulted, including among many of his followers, and the economic damage that's accompanied that. I think that's an example of something that has shown his most loyal followers, or at least some of them, that while facts and logic-based arguments in the past may not have shaken their faith in him, his evident unworthiness of their loyalty is shaking their faith, and I think that's why he's in real trouble. Furthermore, in Joe Biden, he's facing a candidate who has very strong counter-Enlightenment skills. Biden is very good at the personal, subjective connection, which is typical of the counter-Enlightenment worldview, and I think that's one reason why Trump fears him as an opponent so much.
And no matter who wins the election this November, you argue in your book that it is possible for each nation, the two nations of America, to overcome their own biases, their blind spots, and try to find common ground. Is that really possible? How do we even begin to do that?
Well, it starts with suspending judgment, actually. One of the key sources of the division that we see, that sources of the heat in the division that we see, is moral judgment. And it's hard for us to shake the habit of judging everything in terms of good and evil. And this is this manifests in the Enlightenment worldview in thinking in terms of, well, they're just wrong. You know, I've looked at all of the evidence, and these people are just wrong. You can't reestablish a broken relationship on that basis, and I would invite people to try it in their own personal relationships if they're willing to take the risk. Try arguing, say, with a partner or a spouse in terms of, well, you're just wrong.
It doesn't usually work very well.
Right. And, you know, what does work is to try to understand reality from their point of view. Because even people who are doing the things that might look to you to be crazy, irrational, or even evil, in almost no cases did those people wake up in the morning thinking, how can I do evil today? In almost every case, they're convinced they're doing the right thing. And so the way that we can get out of this on the personal level and with our in our personal relationships with family, friends, and coworkers is to abandon for now the almost addiction we have to judging each other. Abandon the desire to win an argument. And I know in my own life how hard that is.
It's so hard, yeah.
And instead, practice awareness and try to ask questions and try to see the world from the other person's point of view. And if they say something you think is just completely wrong, just take note of it and try not to respond to it. And then from there, talk about shared values. Find an area of shared values. So with the extremely divisive abortion issue, for example, you don't want to debate with somebody if you're on the abortion rights side of that argument and you're debating with somebody who's against abortion rights. You don't want to just argue that again, because we've seen over decades that that argument is endless. What you can do is start by finding common values, and you probably both agree that the life of a child is absolutely precious. And you would never want to harm a child. And once you can establish some shared values there, you might be able to have a discussion along those lines. And don't even try to resolve the underlying argument. Try to build the relationship based on the shared values. Now, this goes against a lot of the way we're brought up, again, especially, well, in both the Enlightenment and counter-Enlightenment traditions, which is to do battle with people we disagree with. But I think it's crucially important that we establish a basic level of trust that has really been very seriously broken. And that's going to be based on starting with awareness, finding shared values, and building that trust. And then down the road, we should be able to get back to having useful debates. But I don't think it's going to happen until we reestablish that basic level of trust.
Such important words at this time. And I want to thank you so much for sharing them. Spencer, really good to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure, Melissa. Thank you.
He's author Spencer Critchley. The new book is Patriots of Two Nations, Why Trump Was Inevitable and What Happens Next. In a moment, the Share the Mic campaign will explain next. Forests move. When a tree dies or is felled, a new one sprouts and shifts the landscape, leading to a natural migration. Enter climate change. Science reporter Zach St. George joins us to talk about ecological efforts to protect woodlands and his hikes with experts to understand the path we're on. His new book is called The Journey of Trees. That's next time on Think. Tonight at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Local chambers of commerce are advocates and networks for local businesses. How those organizations serve their communities, from the big things to the little things, is totally different now.
Going in for a hug, you know, Latinos, we hug and kiss when we see each other. And now not to be able to do that, it's flipped the script in how we operate.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, business for the business of supporting businesses. next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Robin Young. Language experts say it's time to examine racism in language. Phrases rooted in slavery like blacklisted, master bedroom, and soul down the river.
All of these racially biased terms are part of our language. Those are the data that children are using to learn language.
Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Democrats are pushing to update the Voting Rights Act as a fitting tribute for a fallen civil rights icon. There's a certain bridge in Selma, too. Should it now bear his name? I'm Jen White. With plans for memorials around the country underway, we'll share your ideas on how to honor the legacy of the late John Lewis. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. It's called the Share the Mic Now campaign. As well-known white women handed over their social media platforms to black women for the day in an effort to expand their voices. This has sparked a national initiative for female physicians. We welcome two of them from our area this morning, Jacksonville physician Dr. Stacy Tanaway. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And also on the line, Dr. Camila Phillips. Dr. Phillips, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
All right. Dr. Tanaway, let's start with you. How did local doctors do their version of Share the Mic?
Yes. Well, this was a national campaign started by female physicians across the country. So there were 40 non-black female physicians from across the country that paired with 40 black female physicians all across the country. And I just happened to be the one local female physician that joined into the campaign. And my partner, Dr. Camila Phillips, is up in New York City. So this was really a nationwide effort.
So did you hand your social media platform over to Dr. Phillips?
I did for the whole day yesterday, and it was amazing.
So, Dr. Phillips, when you had Dr. Tanaway's social media, what'd you do with it?
Oh, my goodness. We had fun. Let me start off by saying Dr. Tanaway is really downplaying her significance in this role. She has been a leader in discussing tough issues on her platform ever since she started. So it was really my honor to pair with her. And yesterday in using her platform, I really tried to discuss experiences that I've had as a black woman in this country from undergraduate facing discrimination in medical school, facing discrimination, and what it's really like to now have this opportunity as a nation to have hard conversations, uncomfortable conversations. And her platform was an amazing opportunity to do just that.
And this was replicated across the country. So this is a way for white women to really be allies and let female professionals of color amplify their voice. This was a nationwide campaign. What kind of feedback did you receive across the country?
I mean, in general, it was amazingly positive. I feel that people were really understanding the courage that the African-American doctors had to speak out on the injustices that they faced in their lives. I think it was an amazing time of reflection for people who aren't of color to really understand the history in this country of racism and inequality. And they were able to use this opportunity to do some reflection and think about how in their personal lives they could do better to move us all forward so that our children can be safe. Dr. Tanaway and I have a lot in common in terms of being, gynecologists, raising children, having a family. And when you start to connect on that level, we realize that we have to do better for our kids and everything else just falls by the wayside. So I think this was a really good time for us to focus on, yes, race, but the fact that at heart, we're women who want to do better for our children in this country.
And Dr. Tanaway, this was a one-day push on social media, but it's something that is ongoing too. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I think there have been many different industries besides just healthcare that have picked up on various versions of Share the Mic campaign and have done various versions. I know we as a collective group of 80 women really felt the power of all of these voices come together in this, and there's already talk of organization of people wanting to do a second round, and I've already gotten messages from other colleagues that say, how can I get involved? Can we do this again? I mean, it's really been a powerful movement yesterday, so it's not going to end there.
You can look at all of the tweets and comments on different social media platforms by just searching the hashtag #ShareTheMicNow. And thank you both so much, both of you, for being part of it and joining us, Dr. Stacy Tanaway and Dr. Camila Phillips, part of a nationwide campaign. Female doctors took part in this week across America. Thanks, ladies.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. We try to share our mic with everybody in this community, especially those who need their voices lifted up. So I was happy to put that segment on. Thanks to everyone who calls and listens every day and all of our guests and producer Heather Schatz, plus director Josh Torres. Let's also shout out news director Jessica Palumbo and digital editor Bill Bordsfield. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We really value your feedback each and every day. We try to answer as many emails as possible. And if you missed any part of today's show, it will re-air tonight at 8 o'clock on this radio station. Our podcast will be up later today as well at wjct.org or wherever you search your favorite podcasts. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back here again tomorrow at 9 for our Friday Media Roundtable, and we really look forward to connecting with you then. In the meantime, have a great Thursday. Be safe, be well, and wear your mask.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.